image, which is there are generally two types of anamorphic images, those that are produced by looking at objects in a very extreme perspective, such as glancing perspective, for example, or anamorphic images which are produced by reflection in mirrors of various kinds. And most people at some time or another have seen those, a cylindrical mirror that produces an image. I'm not going to talk about those second ones. They're very interesting, and we've done work in that. But today it'll just be those that are anamorphic images because of extreme perspective. And whenever you talk about that, you must start with the same picture. Everybody will, assuming that we get it. Oh, I know. And a famous painting called The Ambassadors. It hangs in the National Gallery in London. There are busloads of people who come to the National Gallery. They get off the bus, they rush inside, they look at the ambassadors, and they leave. It's one of the most famous, probably in the list of 10 most famous paintings in the world, done by Holbein. And it's of these two young men, ambassadors from the Flemish area to England. We know who they are, but they're not the subject of the painting. The subject of the painting is this smear down here. And I think many of you will know what that is. This is an anamorph painted by Holbein. And when you look at it, by looking down this axis from this side over here, then the image is resolved. I might comment that this painting is actually a textbook on perspective. The curio cabinet's more interesting than they are. It has all the familiar objects that if you look in the sketchbooks of the time, 1500s, you'll find a student artist practicing on, particularly the lute. There are millions of sketch pad sketches done by students at this time of the lute in all various orientations. But there are all the other things here, the spheres and so on, and even the tessellation in the floor, which you'll notice in every circle is different. Those are all exercises in perspective, and that's what this painting is, in fact, about. So we might ask some questions. Why is the anamorph placed where it is in the painting? Why is it tilted at 26 degrees to the horizontal, which it is? And how is a person expected to view this anamorph? And about a year ago, I decided to address this particular problem since Professor Bernie Nickel and I had published a paper on the mathematical transforms involved in producing these anamorphs. And so I started looking at them again, start with the basic measurements. This painting is life-size. When it's displayed, you are to have the impression, the bottom of it's right on the floor, that it's another room, and you could go over and shake hands with these fellows. So it's full-size. You see the dimensions here, 210 centimeters, 207 centimeters across. That should be a 26 there. The axis of the anamorph is at 26 degrees. Its base is 45 centimeters out from the left edge. And with those, one can start to investigate the reconstruction of the anamorph. And there it is at a high angle. And a sampling of the angles in between. As you can see, and that goes too far. And I'm not going to repeat it because I'm going to be rather tight for time with this new material. But you can look at it at different angles and try and judge where the anamorph has been best reproduced. Here are the stills from there, taken at 18, 14, 12, 10, 8, 6, and 4 degrees. The arrow indicates what subjectively chose as the best reproduction. I went around and asked various people, my wife, for example, which they thought was the best. And generally, people chose in around 8 or 10, not as small as 6, that's too narrow, but around 8 or 10 degrees as being the right angle at which to look at this anamorph. The idea being then, if the painting is here, there's supposed to be a door here. There isn't in the National Gallery, so you have to look at their bad photograph of the anamorph resolved. But the idea was that you're looking at these very prosperous young men. You walk through the door and glance at the painting one last time. You're looking down the axis of the anamorph, and you see not prosperous young men, in the fullness of life, but you see the representation of what we all come to. In other words, it's a memento mori, a reminder of death. So that's the correct observation angle as of this moment. Well, this is just an example of anamorphic images, which were quite popular in the 16th century. And here is one, a very simple one by Marolles. It's a one-dimensional transformation. So it's an anamorph that is intended to be viewed from infinity. Because there's no wedginess to it, right? It has no perspective in it except the anamorphic perspective. And so if you stand back from it, essentially at infinity, and tilt the thing, then you all know what it's going to be. These are not very exciting anamorphs. It's a dog, and of course it is a dog when you transform it by looking at the thing at an angle. So that's a very simple one, but very quickly after Marolles did this, people started to do more realistic ones in which the perspective caused by looking at them from a finite distance was taken into account. And here's an example, an artist, Hedda Erhard Schön, who is a student of Dürer, the famous Dürer, by the way, who made a career of producing these things. And this is his most famous plane anamorph. It looks like some fantastic nightmare landscape. But in fact, it is an anamorph in which you, if you tilt it and look at it from the side, and I have superimposed the solution here, you see four faces in there. These four faces, I've forgotten Pope Paul III, Henry I of Navarre, Francis of Spain, I think. I've forgotten the names exactly. And when we wrote that paper back in 1999, I was satisfied with this. And yet I wasn't satisfied with it. I mean, they're not correct, are they? The pointy noses and things like that. It's certainly not, you know that the faces are there, but it isn't correct. About a year ago, I had a sudden inspiration that Schön had played a game on people here. And in fact, these are wedges. If you look, you can see the wedge shapes in there. There are four of them, and two of them wedged to the right and two of them to the left. So you're intended to look at two of these from the one side and then flip it over and look at the other side. So I reanalyzed all of these with that in mind. And see, there's a left one and a right one cut out of the drawing, and one of them here, which in a moment will move. There we are. And move in the right direction. I chose it in the right direction. Let's see, there we are. And there's a sequence of resolutions of these pictures taken from the right and the left. And fortunately, going on the web, I was able to find what I think is the originals that Schön copied, the portraits that he copied. And with that in mind, again, I went around to people and said, which do you think is the best best solution here? And generally, people chose these things around 11 degrees. And with that in mind, after the ceremonies are over, I have made a viewer here in which you can look at the Schön anamorph through two peepholes on one side and two peepholes on the other side and look at the resolution of these anamorphic images. So, I think I solved that one, at least to this level. I figured out what the trick was that Schön had pulled on us. As I say, Schön made a career of this, selling them for various purposes, even nefarious ones. Oh, that's just marking the 11 degrees that people agreed on. I'll just skip that one. Here's an anamorph done by Erhard Schön, which says, aus du alter Tor, go away, you old fool, the young woman who's being courted by the old man. And why does she want him to go away? Well, if you can stand it, that's why. It's actually a pornographic anamorph from the 1500s. That's what you resolve if you look at the mess on the right by looking at a low angle of about 9 degrees, I think. However, ecclesiastical themes were more common. Here's one, for example, by Glaser, which my computer glasses are getting in the way, which has the Adam and Eve in the garden, and Adam and Eve being expelled from the garden on each side, and an anamorph in the middle. And what is it that connects those two? This is quite typical of the period. It is, of course, the face of God. Is what looks like that lake in the middle is this the face of God. So that's a rather straightforward anamorph. And I obtained at about that time a Xerox copy of the last book on the mathematics of anamorphs that was done before Bernie and I started looking at it, and that was in 1638, when it was all done geometrically. It has not been touched in a serious way since. And having nothing better to do, I decided I would translate this book. It's not available in English. And so I thought I would translate it, which is a bit daring or foolish on my part, since I can't speak French at all. This is 16th century French. But I thought maybe the geometry would get me through it. And it does, it helps, knowing the geometry. So I started translating this this book, and I got through the standard theory of perspective, the horizon theory of perspective, which was well known by that time, had been worked out by Dürer and Da Vinci and people like that. He tells it awkwardly, he's a rotten writer. Even I know that, even I can't speak French, but it's rotten. And I finally got into the anamorphic part where he's going to take the perspective to extremes. And it's suddenly the geometry that I knew didn't correspond with what I thought he was supposed to be doing. And I won't mention what I thought he was trying to solve. But it turned out he was telling me about a type of anamorph that I had never heard of before. I haven't met anyone who has heard of it. It seems to have vanished into history, even though it's much easier to make than those complicated ones with the cylindrical mirrors and things like that. And this was, he was telling me how he was going to make an anamorph that resided on the surface of a cone, and you simply looked at the surface down the axis. I never heard of such a thing before. Sounds like a great toy. You just have this cone picture printed on it, which you can't decipher unless you look straight down. And when I realized that that's what he was talking about, then I knew what geometry needed to be done. This is, I'm not going to go into it, I had to take this out because of time. This is his prescription, taken right out of his book, for making these anamorphs. Everything is done in the form of grids, in which you copy from one grid to another. So in this case, like all of them, you put their drawing of a face or whatever here, and then from each of these little cells, you translate the it down into the other cell and distort it appropriately. You remember when you were a kid how you enlarged or diminished a picture or a drawing for your science project. Well, that's how it's done. And this is a very nice prescription that Nicéron has here. It's an elegant scheme. It depends on tangents, by the way. Unfortunately, it's wrong. And this is surprising because Nicéron in the book confesses when he can't solve something exactly and makes an approximation. He says nothing about this. So I assume he thought it was right. But it's transparently and blatantly wrong. In fact, the actual solution is enormously simpler than the mess he made of that. In fact, it's just simple. Triangles, I don't know how he missed it. It's just simple triangles here in which I want to look from here at the surface of the cone to a projected image on the base. So I want to transform a coordinate y of a general point up to y prime and put that point on the surface of the cone there. You can see that it's absolutely trivial. Here it is over here. You just write down these similar triangle equations and solve it. You find that m prime, the distance down the cone side, is rho, which is this parameter here, the distance in the base, that is the real drawing, over 2 times the radius of the base of the cone minus rho times r, which is the length of the side of the cone. Or if we represent f as rho over r to make it dimensionless, then we have this quantity here, f over 2 minus f times r, which I call the kernel of the transformation. So it's dead easy to do and to apply. And I just wrote down here, Nicéron's kernel is the tangent of f times 45 degrees. And you can see then, for values of f, there's quite a difference between the two. I'm right and he's wrong, but anyway, I want the proof. There it is. I've made one by both prescriptions, actually photographed them, and plotted the points, and you can see the great fall in his, normalized to mine, almost horizontal. There's a scatter here, but that's the difficulty of making a cone that won't fold when you glue the edges together. That's what produces most of that noise. So now I know how to map a drawing onto a cone. So here is an anamorph of a cone. It has to be rolled up into a cone and looked at straight down. And maybe you've guessed what it is, and maybe you haven't. But there's the photograph of the cone after it's made. You can see these the distortions in these are really quite quite severe and interesting. Then, having done the cone, he then goes to, oh, it was made from that drawing, by digitizing that drawing. Oh yeah, this is another case. I wanted to put a square. You see a square when you look down the axis of the cone, and over on the left is the anamorph of a square on the surface of a cone. You roll that up into a cone, and you see squares. One is Nicéron's and one is mine. If you have somebody who knows how to write programs on bitmaps, which I can't do, but I have friends who know how to do that, you can get them to write a program that will process every pixel in a bitmap according to your anamorphic equations. And so here's an anamorph you see on the left in color. And what it is a photograph of a thrush that that friend of mine, Dick Bacon, photographed that summer. So we now have the ability to make this kind of anamorphic image. He then goes on to make things even worse by saying he's going to produce anamorphs on the surface of pyramids. And I like the pyramids because they're easier to make. And this is, he uses the same kind of tangent procedure. It is utterly wrong. The right way to do it, and we're not going to analyze this in detail, only to show that in fact with a pyramid, you can reduce it to the same geometry as a cone, but with a varying r. See this slice here down h, and out here is just a slice through a cone, even though it's a pyramid, except r now varies with the angle instead of being a constant. So the same analysis will in fact produce this the correct result out of the equation which I gave before. And so the problem can always be reduced to the same geometry as for the cone. And here's an example. The one on the left is his. And this one, this is of a grid. So it's supposed to reproduce as a square grid. And you can see that, indeed, it does reproduce as a square grid, but not with his. His prescription is incorrect. And so I've made some of them here. Here's a four-sided cone with an anamorph on it. And I invite you to come up later. This one has been made. I made all this stuff large so you don't have to hold things. It's made so that you can just stand above it and look down and see the reconstruction. And of course, if you can do a four-sided pyramid, you can do any sided pyramid. So I've got a six here. I've made four. I gave up at six. I've done 3, 4, 5, and 6. It all works. And there's a six-sided pyramid with an image on it, which I invite you, after all the festivities are over, to come up and look at, again, by standing above it on, you don't want to fall off, so stand over here and look down on it. And You can see the reconstructions for yourself. And for example, here is a five-sided pyramid. Again, Mickey was recruited to do that one. And there's an example with an R equals one circle on all of them right up to the level of six. Now this is where I interrupted. I was going to go on and say some other things. But about 3 weeks ago, I got an email from a friend in England who said, have you seen the article in The Guardian? Well, how would I see the article in The Guardian? I take The Guardian weekly, but it doesn't have the art stuff in it. And this was the article that appeared by Charlotte Higgins, a well-respected arts reporter, about all becomes clear in an anamorphic painting mystery. Lost 18th century painting that may have inspired Dali will go on a show in London. It's on display in the Hayward Gallery right now, and it goes off the day I arrive there. It looks like an abstract painting, perhaps involving some kind of bridge over a stretch of water. I'll show you the thing in a minute. And a shoreline sprinkled with puzzling objects, giant insects, table-like structures. But squint a little and apply some imagination, and et cetera, et cetera. You get a resolved image. And I had not seen it, but he sent me a scan of the painting. There it is at the top. And it does look like a surrealist landscape with tables and things like that in it. But what they showed, the art historian showed in the paper and in subsequent magazine articles, was that as a reconstruction. It is St. Anthony of Padua, and his symbol is always the image of the Christ child, a book, because he was an orator, and of course a cross and lilies for purity. If you look up St. Anthony of Padua, you'll always find those symbols with him. But all they did with that one was just compress it in the horizontal direction. It looks no more like a proper resolution of the painting than you can imagine. And the colleague and friend in England asked me was, using our equations, could I resolve it properly? And so for the last two and a half weeks, I have been working on that painting in order to find out what we call the POV, the proper point of view where you're supposed to look at these things. And this is how big the painting is. I made a mock-up of it for you. Here, this is the exact size. And I invite you to look at it from the calculated point of view, which is through a peephole over here, down what is the axis of the painting, not the center of the painting, but in fact offset to one side. And that is the kind of thing that we are now able to do with the equations, is to analyze a painting like that in that detail. This turns out to be a rather bad painting. On close examination, it does not have a common perspective horizon, which is ludicrous. Every painting has to have a common perspective horizon. This doesn't. So one can only make compromises. So my colleague at Guelph, Bernie Nickel, and I decided that we would analyze these independently, since we're going to have to make some judgments. And we got together last Thursday to look at what we had chosen as the best set of parameters for this painting. And wonder of wonders, believe it or not, without any collusion, we exactly agreed that we had each chosen the best resolution, which I have set that viewer up for. And well, that's the equations from our paper in 1999 and the geometry in which it is examined. Objects on in XY, can't find the trigger for this, objects in XY are transformed up into the image plane up here to reproduce the image. And those are the equations that do it. And you can see some of the convergences here I had to cope with. You try and find out where all these wedges converge, and unfortunately they converge at various places, but the maximum number of them converge over here, which we are convinced is where the artist intended it all to be, even though he got some of it wrong. So that's where I've placed it, over there. And the axis is in fact low compared to the center line. So, and that's what I have done here. And this is the resolution of the painting. And of course, you don't want to see the wedgy edges of it so we can chop it down and show a better version of it. That's the best resolution that we can come up with, and I think it is the best that anyone can come up with of this painting. There's a bureau here, lilies laying on the surface, and a prayer rug in behind. This perspective is looking over the top of the chest here at these two things laying on the floor, and the table as well resolved as we could. We have to make some compromises with it. And you see these lines that were the legs of the table in the painting. Well, when you look at the painting, you can't see them. Their width is below the level of resolution, so that's cleverly done. Gets rid of those when you actually look at it. Well, that was the project that's involved me for the last 2 weeks. When we had this meeting on Thursday, Bernie said to me, I think I'll rewrite the program so that we can look at them from the left, from the right. He wrote it so we're looking at from the left. That's the way this one was painted. And typical Bernie, this is an absolute genius. I mean, he is the smartest person I have ever met. But if it isn't interesting, he doesn't know about it. And what he didn't know about was that any imaging program worth its salt has got a button you press and do a mirror image. So I told him, I said, all you have to do is go mirror image anything you want to look at from the other side, do it, and then flip the answer back. Oh, said Durney, that's interesting. So off he went, and I went home. By the time I got home, I had received an email with an attached figure with a did you know? He had already done something that was interesting. And here we come full circle. We go back to the ambassadors. He got the ambassadors down and decided to look at it, this time from the other side, because that's the direction you're looking at this one. So you rotate it through 26 degrees till it's horizontal, then you flip it over and use his old program and do an analysis. But in the process, he said to me, did you know that the point of view of this anamorph here is given by a line drawn through their eyes, which are exactly the same height, and go over exactly one picture width, and then draw a line down through the anamorph. Now, of course, Holbein had to have some point of view, and Holbein was a very clever mathematician, so he would have done something mathematical. And sure enough, it's true. There's the geometry. You just duplicate the painting, draw a line through all the eyeballs here to there, draw a line down here to the center. It goes right through the occiput of the skull, which is absolutely essential, as we found, to get a resolution of this skull. So you chop that out and rotate it. There it's rotated, chopped out and resolved. And there's the skull, and that's better than any of the pictures I showed you before at the beginning of the lecture, much better. Not only that, it's extremely robust. And that's very clever on Holbein's part. That's robust in the sense that you can change the distance, and the distances are given in the labels up here in pixels, but that doesn't matter. What is it, 800 and something here, 750, and 1500 here. And at 15 degrees, remember I chose 9 degrees before out of my subjective one? 15 degrees, 13 degrees, they all look pretty well the same. You might cut these off down here, but it's quite a robust thing. So it means that no matter what height you are walking through the door, okay, you're going to see a good resolution of this skull. Now, I have since then searched what literature I have, and I can find no mention of this determination of the point of view. Now, have we really gone through almost 500 years of art analysis, and this has not been noticed? I can hardly believe it, but I can't find any reference to it at all. And certainly the photographic reference or photographic image that they provided National Gallery is nowhere near as good as these. So it's very strange if this has not been noticed. And now we that got me thinking about things that haven't been noticed, and I had a niggling feeling, I'm going to come another full circle before I finish, I had a niggling feeling about that St. Anthony of Padua. Darn it, these art historians said that they'd searched for and discovered this painting. It had been missing for almost a century. They found it in some sculptors, Lifschitz, an American sculptor, they found it in his collection, and this was a great revelation. I thought, either I'm crazy or I've seen it before. I got out my copy of the most famous book ever written about animorphs from the artist's point of view by a man by the name of Jurgis Baltrusaitis. I have a copy. It's not available now. It's a very expensive book, but I spent the money to get it. And I opened it up, and there on page 13 is that painting. So I don't know what's going on in the art world. Does somebody need a grant badly that they looked for something that they could claim was had been lost? Because it clearly states in the text, this is a book written in 1974, that it's in the Lifschitz collection, that Lifschitz has more of these. They implied that this was a painting he had bought and didn't like and just stored it away. And they said that it was painted in the 18th century. The date is given specifically by Baltrusaitis, a very famous art historian, is 1535. So every point in the article in The Guardian has now been denied, at least by the work that I've been doing. And so I want to see if they want to do anything about that at this conference that I'm going to. So that was a bit of a disjointed talk because I wanted to put that new stuff in at the end. I thought you might find it interesting how mathematics can be used in some of these art history projects. If you would like to have a pyramidal anamorph of your own, oh, by the way, I prepared these for fun. And you don't even have to stand over them, you just stand in front of them and look down. Oh, that one unfortunately is bulging a bit. And this one is just really for fun over here because I have encoded a figure in anamorphic projection and then anaglyphed it with red cyan for three dimensions. And so you have to look at it through the glass, this one through the glasses with red on the left. Right, and if you would like to have an anamorph of your own, I have brought 40 copies. Might just work here. It's just a simple child's cutout. You may want your kids to put the thing together. It's a sheet of paper. I'll put them up here. You can help yourself to one of them and take it away. Thank you very much.